because we really want to provide people with a clearer picture as possible and a whole picture as possible, we want to ask that we keep the questions until all the talks are finished. The questions, I just think everybody came in by the car, and we're going to ask that all questions be submitted in writing on the cards. The speakers will then come up on the stage. I will then read the questions to the speakers and suggest who might start to answer them. We'll have an hour for Q&A. Those questions that we don't get to, we'll answer them on the web. Now, I realize that some of you may not agree with some of the opinions here. I ask for a civil behavior to allow everyone to hear what the speakers have to say. I also ask that everyone, including me, turns off their cell phone now. And please treat this as a collegial exchange of information. So I think without any more background, I'd like to get started and introduce the first speaker, who is Stephen Chu, who is the director of Lawrence Berkeley National Lab and a professor of physics and molecular and cell biology.
thing is, why are we focusing on biofuels? In actual fact, we're not. We're focusing on many of the things. This is the list of the things under the so-called Helios umbrella, which is now a very big collaboration between UC Berkeley and LBNL. And biofuels is one part of it. We are also working on solar photovoltaic generation, energy storage, so that it's transient storage, whether it be wind or solar energy or any other transient storage, can actually be more useful. And finally, ultimately, we would like to come up with an artificial photovoltaic system. We submitted a proposal for $15 million a year. We don't know whether we're going to get this, but we hope it will actually grow beyond that in a few years. And in fact, we would like to have each portion of our research be at least equal to the part going to biofuels. So our intent is not to focus on biofuels, but to really make contributions to the problem in areas of technical expertise that is particularly strong at Berkeley and the Berkeley Lab. In terms of energy efficiency, a remarkable thing happened in California since the mid-1970s. It was actually spurred on by a member of the Lawrence Berkeley Lab and also a physics department professor. He left high energy physics and devoted the rest of his career to increasing energy efficiency. And largely to the efforts he started, California has an incredibly outstanding record. It leads the country in keeping down electricity consumption per person in the United States. If you subtract out California from the rest of the United States, the rest of the country increased its electricity consumption per person by 60%, whereas California was essentially stable. It's a record that the University of California and Berkeley Lab are very proud of. If you parse what were those gains made from, they were made from improved building standards, appliance standards, and utility programs. Lawrence Berkeley Lab was effective in all the instances in actually starting the appliance standards, starting with refrigerators and building standards, but we also were effective in teaching the state how to adjust things so that the profits, the shareholders, and the utility power companies were separated from selling more energy. And that's why PG&E is the biggest creature of the energy conservation we have. And in fact, separation of those crucial. We are the only state in the country that has this problem. Solar thermal photovoltaics may be a solution, but they are not there yet. In order to get widespread use of solar photovoltaics and thermal, we need about a factor to decrease in cost watts per dollar without a subsidy, and you need approximately a factor of 10 in order to get widespread deployment. This is a test facility scale. I think that's a couple hundred megawatts, but it has been done with subsidy, and we still need improvement. This is a major goal of what we want, because a lot of the land in the world and a lot of land in the United States is desert, where there are very few people. It's not useful for much of anything except, well, scenic beauty, but we can use 0.2 to 0.3% of this worldwide desert to satisfy all of the current electricity needs in the world at 20% conversion. So it's only a matter of money. So this is not paying the entire desert. This is how little we would need to bring energy everywhere. So we are trying very hard to develop revolutionary new nanomaterials that can be a wet chemistry process that could end up being taken by companies to be manufactured in large scale, very inexpensive. Whether these work or not, we don't know. There are about half a dozen proposals we submitted to the DOE of very novel, very exciting ways of making these new nanomaterials. And we'll see. Another frequently asked question. What fraction of U.S. energy consumption spent on transportation fuel, and why is there such a fuss over transportation fuel? Well, this is 2002, how much we spend in terms of various fuels. This is black and coal, blue is natural gas, nuclear, this is oil, and coal. And you see down here in 2002, we're only, the total U.S. energy consumption is only about 26.5%, maybe 27.5%. So what is all the fuss? Because we're spending the energy on all this other stuff. Well, one reason why there's all the fuss is that transportation fuel is our most important, or most costly, I should say, energy. And the United States spent $250 billion in 2005 importing fossil fuels. Now, if you look at it in perspective, I looked at the U.S. budget for 2005. $440 million was the entire discretionary non-defense budget. Was the non-discretionary budget. So I hope that puts it in perspective. We are spending a lot on fossil fuels. It also, as you know, is really becoming a major factor in the whole world geopolitical situation, having countries having access to oil. Another very scary prospect is the International Energy Agency is forecasting that we, if we continue as we are planning, we will be putting up 3 times as much CO2 in the atmosphere than all of humanity and all of our history. There's abundant fossil fuel from coal, tar sands, and that they hold that the last at least 400 years. We will not run out of fossil fuel. We have enough carbon in the ground to really cook us. And coal is the sole option of U.S., China, and India. In fact, coal is so abundant, there's no serious exploration for coal. And this is the world coal market. And so, if you look at U.S. and China, which is over half the CO2 emissions in the world, we are going to coal today. There are roughly 120-plus coal plants that are in the pipeline, meaning permits are being applied for. And if the permit cycle is maybe 1 to 2 years, that means about one coal plant a week being built in the United States. That's what we're doing today. And that is very scary. In order to reduce the oil dependency because of the economic, because of the geopolitical situation, all countries, including the United States, are looking very hard at breaking this dependency. Liquefaction of coal is very scary because it would essentially mean that 2 to 2.5 times more CO2 will be emitted per gallon driven. It's upscale and upstream and downstream pollution because coal is so plentiful. And then there are unconventional sources of oil, such as the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, which are now being extracted in massive amounts. This is an image I found on Sunday. This is one of the Southern State tar sands. The scale is 5 miles. These are huge open pit extraction of tar sands. There's a lot of energy. About 1 unit of energy extracts 4 to 5 units of oil. The tar is separated from the lighter stuff. It's put in holding ponds now beside the lake. There's no money being set aside to remediate. This is what's happening today. We need a substitute. Okay. Can there be enough arable land to grow food and energy? Well, we have had a green revolution in the world. And this is the population, 1963 billion, it's now up to 6.5 billion. This is the amount of land put under grain production. This is the yield of this grain. And so you can ask, is there enough land in the United States to produce, excess land to produce some biofuels? And if you look, this is U.S. Department of Agriculture statistics in 1982, roughly 420 million acres of cropland, now down to 367. There is a conservation cropland that has grown, but pasture, much of this conservation land also comes from pasture and rangeland. So if you look at these numbers, what you find is in 21 years, this is a decrease in cropland, pastureland, and rangeland. There was an increase in putting much of this land, 31 million acres, in the conservation preserve. But looking to the future, so there's an excess. If you, even if you take the conservation reserve land off the table, there's an excess of tens of millions of acres, and there's anticipated to be a further excess of tens of millions of acres because of world trade agreements that say the United States and other developed countries should not sell heavily subsidized crops to the open market. So we anticipate that there will be much more excess capacity of the level 46 million acres. Another question, growing corn and ethanol doesn't reduce greenhouse emissions and can only replace a small fraction of U.S. oil use. How any other biofuel help CO2 emissions and be a significant part of the energy solution? That question is correct. This is the amount of CO2 emitted if you drill a hole in the ground, get out some oil, refine some gasoline, and drive around. If you look at today's modern equivalent, these are many authors, but the average would be an analysis of corn and see it's not much better. To grow the amount of CO2 that you emit in growing the corn because of all the fertilizers, the tractors, and everything else, than just burning gasoline. There's a slight positive in terms of energy, but it's nothing to write home about. That is to say, the sunlight captured by the corn makes the total energy a little bit positive with respect to gasoline, which you can say is zero. This is what we anticipate for cellulose, so that the CO2 emissions would be down by roughly a factor of 8 to 10, and the, it would be completely net positive in terms of converting sunlight energy to transportation if it's done right. That is done using the combined systems of cellulose, not corn. And that is, in fact, the essence of what we want to work on. Because right now, the country is growing corn with ethanol, and it is simply the wrong way. And I think all the people who have looked at this will agree with that, that it is simply the wrong thing to do. What is the right thing to do? Well, this is part of the reason. But as an example, this is a picture of some a grass called the Canton, I guess. This is a graduate student of one of our collaborators in the University of Illinois, and these are foot markers, so you can get the size scale of what the graduate student is and what the grasses are. This is growing on unirrigated, unfertilized land, and if that grass is converted to ethanol, it will be effectively 10 times higher than what we can now get from corn for acre. So this is why it's so important to go to a better crop than corn and to develop those technologies. Current U.S. agricultural practice is not the least sustainable. Very heavy irrigation, the water tables are shrinking. There's a lot of fertilizer and nitrate runoff. This is true in California, it's true in the Midwest. So low growing crop trends make this problem worse. Actually, no. It will break the current back. These grasses are perennial. That means you plant them once, and then you leave them, the roots stay in the ground for 10 or 15 years, and they come up every successive year as grasses. Because their roots spend all this time, they can develop symbiotic relationships with bacteria that fix nitrogen, so they make a lot of their own fertilizer. That dependent egg plant would actually withdraw a lot of the essential nutrients from the leaves of the plant near harvest time and put them back in the roots. And so you go and you chop off the upper stuff, turn that into a biofuel, but a lot of the nutrients are back in the ground, and because of that, these grasses can have 1 inch of nitrogen around 1/100th of soil erosion of corn. That's why everybody is so interested in growing grasses. Well, these grasses are so much better than corn or even sugar cane. They can be effectively too better than sugar cane. Why isn't this done today? The answer has to do with money. Right now, with the technology for converting sugar cane or U.S. corn is simple starch into ethanol. This is base case, is what the costs are today. At 90 cents a gallon in Brazil, you can buy PA5 ethanol mixture with gasoline at lower price than you can buy 100% gasoline unsubsidized. This is higher, so this is subsidized. This is the current prices for switchgrass or corn silver. And the hope is that this is a BP analysis. The hope is that those prices can be brought down in 5 years or so to where farmers would readily switch from growing corn to growing type of grain. The improvements are there. This is a commercial pilot ethanol production plant from cellulose. It's very energy intensive. It's very expensive. And if you look at how one changes the cellulose into this fuel, it can be much improved. This is another type of cellulose reduction plant. This is in the gutter of the termite. And this is one example of how we, in collaboration with a small startup company called Diversa, are trying to understand how the microorganisms in the stomach of termites can efficiently turn woody materials like your house into the energy that the termite can use. And so it's a basic understanding of what these microbes are doing. We hope can lead us to a much improved method. I want to end by just it was charged that we kind of trampled over the Senate procedures and the way we do things. So this is hoping to get the facts out. It is true that that a lot of this program actually started in 2004, but when the BP got to us sometime in June, or that summer, 2006, 2 years later, and in early September, BP actually came and visited and said, we may be interested in asking you to submit a proposal in early September 2006. Immediately thereafter, the university, under Beth Burnside's office and Beth herself, began regular meetings with two Senate, the critical academic Senate committees, the Academic Planning and Resource Allocation Committee, CAPRA, and also the Committee on Research. And early in September, she also sent memos to deans, chairs, and directors regarding this proposal. So that happened very soon after it was suggested that we may be asked to apply. October 10th, a letter from the Science and Engineering Dean to the Provost said, urged that the university commit new faculty positions for this proposal, which still hasn't, of course, been budgeted, but this was communicated to the deans, and the deans responded by October 10th. October 17th, we actually finally were asked to submit a proposal. So all this stuff right before the actual submission of the proposal, and we see that they only gave us a very short time span. We were 6 weeks from the time we submitted a proposal to the time we actually submitted a proposal. But I want to emphasize that as soon as we knew that we had a chance of being asked to apply, the academic senate was engaged. And with that, I will stop.
Thank you. Next speaker is Chris Summermill. Chris is professor of biological sciences and director of the Carnegie Institute of Plant Research at Stanford University and a visiting scientist at Lawrence River National Lab.
Steve actually gave quite a few of the bits of my talk, but I did want to just start off by pointing out that whatever it is that is likely to happen here at Berkeley in regard to EDI, it's not about corn ethanol. So as this slide showed, corn ethanol has become a very large activity. I think next year corn growers expect to produce about 6 billion gallons, and the farm growers expect us to go to about, or the farm growers expect us to go to about 12 billion gallons at which it should stop, because the demand for corn for other purposes will not allow it. I thought this would be a useful place to begin as to one of the drivers, and I just want to say, from my perspective, and I believe most other people that I know of that are interested in biofuels, the sole driver for it is the kind of concern that Steve expressed about climate change. And it arises from the fact that if you look at human energy use, which is 13 terawatts, the instantaneous rate of use, 13 times 10 to 12 watts, and look at where we could obtain that amount of energy from, you can see that, for example, the DOE's analysis suggests we could get worldwide about 4 terawatts from wind. And wind is an excellent technology. It's mature technology, but because we need persistent wind to amortize the cost of the machines, and so the DOE at least thinks that's the upper limit. We could get several terawatts from tides and currents, and we've almost used the capacity for hydro. So there is some capacity for geothermal that's unexploited, actually quite a lot of capacity, but a lot of that is located at places in the world that are not close to population centers, and so the losses through the transmission of that energy are high, and there's some limitations. Nuclear has reappeared, but put it in perspective, just to understand what the real challenge is. The average nuclear power plant is 1 gigawatt, 10 to 9 watts. If we wanted to just stay where we are today in terms of carbon emissions, we need to build a new nuclear power plant every 2 days for the next 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's how rapidly energy use is currently expanding. So I don't think anyone here believes that's a tenable proposition, and you know, we don't see that as a real option. So nevertheless, it just gives you a sense of magnitude of the problem that we're trying to deal with. So when you look at the options, this is the one that really stands out. This is how much solar arrives on the surface of the Earth each day or year. We get about some instantaneous rate of 100,000 terawatts of solar coming into the planet. That's 10,000 times as much energy as all human energy. So the real challenge in some ways, and Steve has addressed this with the goals of the Helios project, the challenge is to find out how it is that we can capture solar in a sustainable way. Now, when we say solar, most people think of photovoltaic. So Nate Lewis, a colleague at Caltech, has calculated that if we could build 160,000 square kilometers of photovoltaic, that we could meet U.S. energy needs. That's how big it would be. Just put it in perspective, all photovoltaics made in the history of the planet are 4 kilometers square. So that's a pretty tall order, and it's not something that's immediately going to be available to us, and although hopefully that will be solved in the coming years. So the remaining way of really capturing solar is to use natural systems which are able to capture photons from sunlight through photosynthesis. That energy is used to condense CO2 into polysaccharides. Polysaccharides can then be burned back into CO2, and the heat release produces work. That's the essential equation. So the harvest sunlight is carbon neutral because the CO2 cycles. And so our goals are to try and understand whether that can be implemented on a large enough scale to be useful. So one way of asking that question, there's a lot of interest in the degree to which we can use photosynthesis as a source of energy. And one way to think about it is shown here. So if we use the number 90,000 terawatts coming to the surface of the Earth, and 71% of it is water, so probably we really can't capture energy on the surface of water. Nevertheless, if we could just capture 1% of the energy that's incident, we would need about less than 5% of the land area to meet all human energy needs at only 1% efficiency. Now, of course, the goals at the moment are not to meet all human energy needs. The Secretary of Energy's stated goals are 30% of transportation fuels by 2030. So it's a pretty modest goal. So I think that in the context of meeting all human energy needs, it's a tiny fraction that actually is really what we need to go after right now. And part of the reason it's targeted at that particular component of the energy system is that it seems almost certain that, as Steve mentioned, coal is going to be burned on a massive scale in the years to come. So there is the possibility of sequestering a lot of the carbon from coal into deep aquifers or other cavities in the Earth at the sites, for example, where electricity is made. So where very large amounts are used at one location. The transportation fuel doesn't lend itself to that, so we need a way to make transportation fuels. So back to the 5% number, what does that mean in terms of global land use? So you can see this is how we currently use land. About 35% is not arable. We use about 5% for cereals and about 7% for all other crops. And quite a bit of the surface is not used directly for food, although the argument that pasture and range is relevant. So again, this of course doesn't say whether there's adequate land to really meet our needs. But the situation is not desperate at this moment. One of the goals of the EDI, a very large goal in fact, is to look at this situation worldwide as a group of social scientists and economists, one of whom we'll speak later in the session, that are charged with looking at the global energy situation, global land use, social equity issues, and try to understand what a global biofuel industry will do to social equity, economics, land use, food production, and those kinds of issues. And I think I can say on behalf of the colleagues here that nobody wants to support a situation that creates harm or hardship. Now, to come back to whether 1% solar yield is feasible. Our colleague Steve Long, this has been shown before this is campus, but it's over 18 inches deep. So this property is close to about 14 feet. Steve has been growing this campus on the, this has been growing on the University of Illinois campus without irrigation, or actually it's never been fertilized. This plant yields on the Illinois campus about 26 tons a year per acre. And Steve has calculated that actually the solar efficiency of this on an annualized basis is about 2%. So if we discounted for the fact that we would lose about half of that energy, at least in converting it to a useful fuel, I'll come back to that in a moment. We think that 1% solar yield is feasible, at least on certain acres. It's certainly not true of many acres that, that will only support lower productivity, and I'll come back to that in a moment. So our interest, I can say that within the EBI, one of our goals will be is to really understand what are the species like this, what can they produce, and what are their requirements for cultivation. We also need to deal with the general problem that if one is going to use a plant as a source of energy, we pretty much need to have it available throughout the year. So there is an issue of how we harvest it, how we store it, and how it becomes how it gets delivered to the sites of use. That kind of work, in fact, the agronomy of how is the plant grown and harvested, and how much genetic variability, and those kinds of issues are really going to be carried out at University of Illinois, where agronomy and agricultural engineering, there's a lot of expertise in that. Now, one of the reasons I just want to mention that we're interested in certain grasses is that these perennial grasses in particular are very productive because, as you can see here, the blue line is the annual photosynthetic cycle of corn. The yellow line is two perennial grasses, Acanthus and Spartina. And you can see that because of the perennial roots, when the snow blows off, they get an early start and they fill the canopy quickly. And so the net photosynthesis is the area under the curve. So they're very productive because they have a long season and they get an early start. They're also productive because the perennial root, as Steve mentioned, is a reservoir for nutrients, so that when the crop is taken off, you can see that it's already dry and actually it's dead. It's snow on the ground. So when the fall, at the end of the season, these plants withdraw mineral nutrients back into the roots so that they make very efficient use of mineral nutrients. And indeed, they increase the soil carbon. They have extensive root systems, and Steve Wong, our colleague at Illinois, has measured large increases in soil organic carbon with continuous cropping of this species. Indeed, Europeans have carried out a 10-year, 15-site study of this cancer throughout Europe, all the way from Sweden in the north to Portugal and Greece in the south, and have concluded the same thing, that these perennial grasses enrich soil organic carbon and actually are very benign in regard to supporting small animal life in the crop. The small animals that, and insects that live in the crop complete their life cycle by the time the crop finishes. So we feel very positive about these perennial grasses. But one other thing I should mention is why it's going to be perennial grasses is that most of the species we're interested in are what are called C4 grasses. And they use a type of photosynthesis that's very energy for water efficient. So a grass like this Acanthus will use about one third as much water as a tree like poplar, for example, per kilogram of dry matter. Now, to take a different analysis of whether we can produce enough biofuels, I want to show this well-known slide from a USDA DOE study that was concluded in 2005, in which government scientists looked county by county around the United States and did an analysis of how much biomass was excess to agricultural needs. They concluded that if one used, for example, half of the corn clover, half of the wheat straw, and various other crop residues and waste, that the United States could produce 1.3 billion dry tons of biomass. To put that in perspective, one dry ton will produce about, well, the theoretical yield is about 110 gallons of ethanol. You can see that that would produce about 130 billion gallons of ethanol from what claim to be excess of the current agricultural needs. I'm a bit uncertain whether it will, this will be the, what the future looks like. But it does give another indication from a completely different angle that there is quite a bit of excess biomass. One of the reasons I feel this uncertain is we just focus on corn stover. Our study is shown here by a colleague, Ken Vogel, a USDA scientist at Nebraska. And for some years, Ken has been studying what happens to the productivity of corn in half of the stover. You can see that from the beginning of huge annual fluctuation yield, but you can also see that after several years of living, the yield of the corn is beginning to decline. Ken believes that this is due to reduction of soil organic carbon that's supporting microflora or microorganisms and mobilized nutrients. We actually don't know what the basis for that is, and that's certainly going to be something that's studied in the EBI. We need to understand how widespread this is, what the relationship between this effect and soil type is and waterfall and we have a lot of tools available to study this now. For example, it's become possible to sequence the microorganisms in soil samples to understand their abundance and diversity, and I think that will be a very useful tool for understanding the scientific level. So for reasons that I and other people have some concerns about removing crop residues, I personally believe that we're going to see dedicated energy crops. There's such as this cannabis that are perennials that can be grown in a continuing way that don't decrease the soil organic carbon and don't need the kind of input of chemicals and fertilizers that conventional field crops need. The DOE has been working on this for some time, and they have a kind of a map of the United States in which they've identified the regions that should be suitable for these new so-called energy crops. You can see the Bear region, for example, and the switchgrass, and the hybrid poplar, maple, and so on. I think, you know, work has been done in this area ever since Jimmy Carter became interested in the energy problem in the mid-70s. And so there is a base of information, and we hope to build on that and understand it more deeply. The limitation as to what's really possible is shown here. And that is, this is the rainfall map of the United States. So you can see that in the DOE vision, pretty much all the action is comprised of Mississippi, because you can see here, probably can see the green zone where the water is. So plants use a lot of water. The I've ever heard of is that a plant like cannabis can produce about 1 gram of biomass for 200 grams of water. Another, a plant like alfalfa uses about 600 grams of water for 1 gram of biomass. So, there's no doubt that we need to have a term that water is actually going to be the main limitation for the productivity of the crop. And that's why we're interested in corn grass, because of their efficiency. We hope to have people look at what land use throughout the regions that could support a biofuel production industry, not only in the United States, but around the world, and try to understand the interaction between soil water retention, soil use, and the plants that appear on their base that they can find. So, in general terms, on the plant side or the feedstock side, the kinds of questions that will motivate our research are: what species are most suitable, what species of plant? What are the best agronomic practices? How can plants be improved? That is, everything that we're considering is currently a wild species. What's the range of genetic variation? It's going to be very important. We try to modify the composition of the plants, and also things like pest and pathogen resistance. Are there sustainability issues? What are the pest and pathogen pressures? And how can the plants be harvested and stored? I think I've already mentioned that we expected the energy crop to be much more environmentally friendly than production agriculture. One of the things that I think is going to be important here is that mixed cultures are possible. So plant breeders who work on field crops have been trying for many years to make what are called mixed cultures or multi-line. But in general, it's been difficult in field crops because they don't mature at the same time or they don't have the same height and stuff. However, because these crops will be harvested after the end of the season, we believe it's going to be possible to have mixed cultures, certainly mixed genotypes, and probably mixed species. All right, I want to turn to the other component of this. I'm actually running out of time, I think. In terms of making fuel from biomass, the current technology is that basically you're grinding up the biomass, you keep it in hot acid, that hydrolyzes some of the sugars, which can then be fermented. The other sugars then subjected to enzymatic hydrolysis and then fermented to produce ethanol. I mentioned this slide because I think it's going to make an important point from a critic of the technology. So Dr. Patek and his colleagues have pointed out that if one just grows switchgrass and burns it, you can get an energy yield of about 15-fold. I think this is a very important observation because it indicates where the issue is in terms of energy efficiency. And if there's not a life cycle, there's not a problem in growing and harvesting and using biomass for energy. The problem is in converting it to a liquid fuel like ethanol. So these authors would claim that if you then go from this 15-fold return, it goes negative because the conversion is not efficient. And everyone here will know, perhaps, that Cam and colleagues have pointed out that it probably doesn't go negative, but I think the general trend is true, that a lot of energy goes into this conversion. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. What that means is that we should understand how to do it. Okay? I don't think that's a very important difference. So, in that respect, most of the research, actually, in the EPI, as we envision it, will be trying to understand how to go from this form of biomass, this wood, which if you look up close, is made of these overlapping polysaccharides. Those polysaccharides are typically coated in lignin, shown here, or here's an actual structure of the lignin. And the lignin basically occludes the access of the enzymes to the polysaccharides. You can see here, for example, that if you look at the ability of enzymes to hydrolyze polysaccharides as a function of the lignin content, there's a strong negative relationship. We know the pathway by which lignin is made, and so there is interest in the degree to which we can breed plants that have modified lignin composition to make this less of a problem. But the other more promising approach is to look for catalysts that can, such as improved enzymes or I believe some synthetic or organic catalysts may be useful, that are able to hydrolyze the polysaccharide with lower inputs of energy on the front end, that is, the deconstruction process. Currently, it's using a lot of hot acid and a lot of electricity. Hopefully, we can, with the use of better catalysts and perhaps improved feedstocks, we can decrease the amount of energy and make the net energy yield more attractive. Steve showed this slide, which is part of the scientific strategy, that is, up to now, work on the enzymes that can hydrolyze plant cell walls to sugar is rather preliminary. A lot of work has been done on a small number of enzymes. But now, with the ability to sequence whole genomes at very low cost, the nearby JGI, Joint Genome Initiative, has that capability in space. There's a new approach, which is to go out and sequence organisms that do it naturally, such as the organisms in the termite duct that are able to hydrolyze polysaccharides and in animal ruminants and forest floors. I think we, soil would be much deeper than it is if there weren't a lot of organisms out there that have the ability to break down cellulosic biomass, and we need to find those organisms, find the relevant enzyme systems, and learn how to adapt them for our purposes. Additionally, there's a lot of talk about cellulose, but actually, if one looks at the composition of biomass, in addition to the lignin and the cellulose that I referred to, there's a major component called hemicellulose, which is generally non-glucan, that is, sugars that are not glucose, such as xylose, is a very common sugar. In order to make the overall process efficient, we have to be able to ferment all the sugars. And pathways are known that are capable of doing this, but these pathways are not expressed in organisms that are adapted to industrial fermentation. So one of our goals will be to understand how to either adapt new organisms to large-scale industrial fermentation, or have the capability of fermenting all sugars, or to move pathways for certain types of sugar metabolism into adaptive strains. And work with J.C. Kiesling as a pioneer. Finally, to return to this slide, at the present, the whole industry is focused on ethanol, and I would say that's entirely historical. That is, there was already a large ethanol industry when the possibility of making biofuels really emerged, and so the current corn ethanol industry is basically built on just an extension of that existing ethanol industry. But the reality is, if we had to choose a fuel, it surely wouldn't be ethanol. One of the reasons is that the organisms that make it die when they get to about 12% solution. And so you end up investing a lot of energy to distill it at the end. So if you want to get some energy out of it, make something that doesn't need to be distilled. So Jay has kindly provided us just a cup here in which you can see oil sitting on water. You know, it partitions spontaneously out of the aqueous phase, as everyone here knows. So one of the strategies for making true biofuels is to make something that has composition a lot more like oil and a lot less like ethanol. And indeed, we know many organisms that make various kinds of oily compounds, terpenoids, alkanes, as well as lipids, all of which could be used for fuels. And in fact, current fuels are mostly alkanes, and so that certainly seems like an interesting direction to go in. I wanted to mention that we hope to be completely open to the possibility that there are technologies that are not fundamentally biological. So, for example, colleagues at the University of Wisconsin have been doing very elegant chemistry on devising new catalysts that can take sugars to alkanes through totally synthetic chemistry. This has some advantages if we indeed end up with a large supply of hydrogen, which I believe we're going to because of the coal can be reformed to hydrogen and the CO2 can be sequestered. So this may be a combination of the use of biofuels with intelligent use of coal. But in this case, using sugars from biomass as a carrier for hydrogen could be an interesting approach to generating new generation of fuels. So I think I would summarize. I went through actually a tremendous amount of different possibilities rather too briefly, I suspect, but it's not actually that complicated in the end. The main scientific goals of the Institute, aside from developing feedstock, is to identify or create more active catalysts for conversion of biomass to sugars, to develop industrial microorganisms that can ferment all sugars, and to develop microorganisms that produce and secrete more hydrophobic compounds such as alkanes. You know, we have about 200 million cars in the United States, I believe, and only 4 million of them can burn more than 10% ethanol. So when one hears the president talking about these goals of having, you know, very large amounts of ethanol, there's kind of a problem in terms of actually accomplishing that anytime soon. It's complete, we'll have to turn over. So there's an interesting driver to try and change the fuel that are being made. Many questions have to be answered. In fact, I want to remind everybody that what's being discussed here is a research project. And our goals include really a lot. We have a lot of questions. On the social side, I would say some of the ones are that we want to know what the trade-offs are between environmental effects of climate change and cultivation of land for biofuels. I don't think these things are self-evident. You know, we can see that climate change is look very bad on an environmental sense. We don't really, I would say, we have not studied the trade-off between that and the possibility of using hundreds of millions of acres for fuel. What are the probable effects on poor people and social equity worldwide? We need to be sure that as we create, or if an industry is created around biofuels, and I think we can expect it to be an international industry. You know, the recent talks between Lula and Bush indicate there's already some discussion about changing the trade situation. I think we need to make sure that we don't support something that doesn't support social equity or has bad effects on poor people, or create perverse incentives. For example, I think the use of biodiesel in Europe has been very unfortunate in that it's caused expansion of palm oil in Malaysia by short-sighted social policy in Europe. We also need to know what kinds of policies should be in place to prevent undesirable social or economic effects in those parts of the world that we don't actually control directly. Finally, I just want to mention one other thing, and that is what's the alternative to the general approach of taking support from the industry. I like this slide, or I hate this slide in some way. I guess I hate it.
So the red line down here is the energy budget of the United States. So you can see, this is when Jimmy Carter became alarmed about the situation. But you can see that what's happened is that today, the energy research budget is actually a tiny little pimple on the national budget. This, by the way, is not the military budget, that's the military research budget. $64 billion a year this year. So, from my perspective, when a company with you know, the willingness to stand up and try and change the energy industry is willing to allow an institution like Berkeley, which is well known to be, I would call it a socially aware institution, I think that should be embraced rather than somehow dealt with as suspiciously. Because it could have a very important impact on our ability to do research in the topics that are germane to understanding what's really possible with climate change. Okay, I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker is Jay Keebling. Jay is Professor of Chemical Engineering and Bioengineering and the Director of the Physical Bioscience Division at Lawrence Berkeley Medical Center.
Have various areas of research in the aspects that I showed you before.
we anticipate recruiting 10 new faculty positions, 7 at Berkeley and 3 at Illinois. In a very short time, we'll have calls for proposals across the campus for investigators to put their ideas in to how they can do research that will fit within EBI. And this is going to be a broad call because we want to enlist as many people in as many different areas at Berkeley as possible, as well as at Illinois and at LPL. Those research proposals will then be vetted within the executive committee. And in all of this research, we hope to involve undergraduates and graduate students, as well as postdoctoral fellows. And given the size of the grant, this means that a large number of undergraduates and graduate students, as well as postdocs, will be able to do research in EBI. Not only do we want to do research, but we want to educate graduate students, postdocs, and undergraduates. We're going to provide BP investigators broad access to campus and lab and intellectual resources as visiting scholars. And that means they'll be able to take classes as well as potentially give lectures in our courses. We plan to educate the next generation in energy science. And we want these postdocs, graduate students, and undergraduate students to have a very broad education, not only in science, but in the social aspects of it, as well as the economics. We also want to educate the public, the general public, public policy students, policymakers, and of course influence K-12 students, not only in the areas of research, but also enlisting them to get into science and be more interested in science, showing them that, in fact, science can make a difference. And as well, we will provide extension activities, and this is a lot of the work that will go on at Illinois, so that we can influence farmers and talk to farmers about their needs and how to get crops into the fields for the future. There will be some very broad undergraduate education goals. We plan to develop new undergraduate courses as well as freshman seminars. There will be advising of undergraduates doing research in the EBI over the summer and also during the term. And there will also be research internships with BP labs worldwide, as well as the burgeoning biofuels industry in the Bay Area. And of course, there will be other programs like the Bioenergy Entrepreneurship Program and field training internships and practicums at bioenergy plants and farms. As I mentioned, we also want to have a broad outreach agenda, and that is to really talk to the greater scientific community. Of course, there will be publications coming from the research here, and everything that will be done by university researchers will be published in high-profile peer-reviewed journals. We'll also have short and intensive summer courses, annual symposia, and regular seminars. In fact, there will be a call for proposals shortly for Berkeley and when I say Berkeley, both UPB and LPL investigators to organize and impose a one-day symposia that will be funded by the EBI, bringing researchers from the outside to talk about some of the most important issues in biofuels research. We'll have electronic newsletters and press releases, as well as graduate and undergraduate research journals. As I mentioned, it's important to influence young minds and to get them into science. We plan to send EBI investigators out to high schools to give lectures, to train teachers, particularly over the summer, where we can invite them in to be part of the research. We'll have a day in science where K-12 students will actually get to come into the laboratories and learn what's going on. Summer internships, which we're already doing, but we plan to enhance. And then an iGEM competition for students to actually design research projects and carry them out over the summer. And as I mentioned before, we plan to partner with the agriculture community and the education Extension Education Service to transfer relevant EBI knowledge to farmers and the greater agriculture community. So if at any time you have questions at the end here or beyond my talk and this meeting today, please feel free to contact us. If you want more information about what's going on, a lot of this is still being developed because we're initiating this deal with BP. But we plan to inform you
through representatives from the back of the Senate as a part of that negotiation.
Next, we have Carolyn Laura, who is Assistant Vice Chancellor for Intellectual Property and Industry Research Alliances here at UCB. And she's going to talk to us about how the intellectual property arrangements work and what our principles are.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me? I'm very happy to be here today. Thank you for the invitation, and thank you for your interest in this subject. I must admit that when I saw the agenda today, I thought, oh, great, I'm in a lineup following a Nobel laureate. And last year's winner of the Valcon Prize, and then the person who won the Science of the Year Award for Discover Magazine, it's not a good place to be, but I'm hoping that with your indulgence, I'll survive this experience. I want to start out with a message that's very simple and yet very, very important, and that is that the University of California has 8 underlying principles that govern rights to future research in contact with external parties. So I've shown them here. There are 8 of them, and I've also given the URL at the bottom of the page. It's also been printed out as a handout today, and also that URL gives an explanation of the genesis of the principles. And these principles are very important and very necessary to uphold who we are as a university and what we do, given that our mission is teaching, research, the dissemination of information, and public service. And, too bad, you can't see my picture. I was going to ask you if you were wondering what food is doing up here in this PowerPoint, but it was a picture of an apple pie because I wanted to convey that these principles are foundational. They're really as foundational as motherhood and apple pie to us. They're really worth falling on our sword over things like the ability to publish, the commitment to educate students, the ability of our research results, public benefit, the informed participation of researchers to understand any terms and conditions in a contract that affect them, legal integrity and consistency in contracting, also fair consideration in granting rights to future research results to those at the university, and objective decision making. So in these call for proposals, they challenge academic institutions to propose how they would envision a new institute for energy biosciences that consisted of 2 overarching sides, an open component and a proprietary component. And the open component consists of people doing basic academic research as usual. The research is performed by academics, in this case, people from UC Berkeley, from Illinois, and LBNL. All of the research in the open side is published, and the results belong to those academic institutions. On the other hand, in the proprietary component of the UBI, which we're calling the Commercial Applications Lab, the research is performed by UC employees in closed lease space. The research is confidential, and the results belong to UC. So UBI's open and proprietary components help us to implement a shared vision to achieve global energy solutions. And we know that the conversion of science to technology can be expedited through innovative public-private partnerships. And in fact, from long experience in certain disciplines, and in particularly in the engineering and agriculture disciplines, we know that industry input provides us with valuable insight into which problems of society need to be solved, and both where academics can help and how academics can help to solve those problems. So, for many decades, university research discovery has been commercialized by the private sector. And at UC, as part of our mission, you may recall hearing President Bob Dine saying that UC is about R&D, research, development, and delivery. And a few examples of discoveries that are products or currently being commercialized from UC Berkeley alone are listed on the slide in the medical field, in the health field, therapeutics, diagnostics, pharmaceuticals, in the information technology field, an internet search engine, a drug scheduling algorithm, many medical devices, including a tumor ablation device and a vascular stent, research tool, primarily for DNA sequencing and DNA sequencing instrumentation and protein modeling software, just to name a few. So university technology transfer is practiced throughout the U.S. and Canada, and it's a very fast-growing practice worldwide. So given that university results are basic research results that are very far from being a commercial product, technology transfer, or the road to commercialization, is truly a very long and winding road, and that road is full of potholes. So commercial investment in and by the private sector is required to bring basic research results to the point of practical application. So, and typically a series of steps are required to bring a nascent embryonic basic bench result to the point of being a real product. And often multiple parties are required to participate in this process. And in this schematic, I've shown some of the steps. And importantly, at the bottom, with the red line, I've shown that in the case of drug development, that long and arduous development process can take over a decade and can cost easily over $1 billion. So the translational research gap is both wide and deep. And university research in early stage embryonic results are far from being a product, as I said. But universities don't commercialize their own results. We don't have manufacturing capability, we don't have factories, we don't distribute what we invent, and we're nonprofit institutions. So rights to university IP are licensed to companies in the private sector. And in this context, a license is a contract that grants to an industry licensee the right to commercialize a patented invention to make a product. So, and licensees of a patent right invest enormous sums of many dollars and many, many employees in risky R&D, manufacturing, and regulatory approvals to bring early-stage technologies and to productize them. So, now a patent is a form of intellectual property that grants the owner or the owner's licensee the right to make and sell products based on the patented invention and to exclude others from doing the same. So without the protection afforded by an IP license, industry would never risk the funds and resources on lengthy R&D programs that are necessary to productize an invention. So because if at the end of a long and arduous R&D period, the licensee and all of the licensee's competitors could commercialize the product, no company would invest the first dime to begin with. So the bottom line is that IP licensing gives industry an incentive to invest. So turning now to the IP and contracting structure in the EDI, we will implement a shared vision of creating long-term and robust energy solutions by implementing a master-sponsored research agreement between UC and BP. So the terms and the conditions of this agreement will be passed along. It will be flowed down to Lawrence Berkeley Lab and the University of Illinois. The terms and conditions will be flowed down, and the money will be subcontracted in standard subcontracting ways to those institutions. But in terms of now, I've introduced the concept of a master-sponsored research agreement. What is a sponsored research agreement? Well, typically the process starts when a university researcher who is seeking financial support for a particular research project proposes a plan to a research sponsor along with the corresponding budget. And that budget details what the actual cost of the research will be in terms of personnel, equipment, and reagents. And this type of agreement also assesses full indirect costs, which have worked at 52% of the direct cost. So the indirect costs pay for campus infrastructure, the cost of building maintenance, utilities, and the library and such things, the infrastructure under which research occurs. And then the resultant research results are reported to the sponsor periodically in writing, and the university retains ownership of those results as well as ownership of the IP. Now, the sponsor may request the university to file a patent on the funded IP, or the university could file of its own accord to protect the IP. And of course, the eight guiding principles are always followed when drafting sponsored research agreements, And in this agreement, at least these faculty members will also be asked to help us negotiate and review this contract at the appropriate time with input before it's signed. I've also provided a handout called How Academic Freedom and Academic Principles Are Preserved in Sponsored Research Agreements, so that you can see exactly how academic freedom is preserved and the timing of agreement with external parties. In terms of, again, the sponsored research agreement, given that it's a master agreement that does not have a predefined work plan, because that would be the limit, people at Berkeley will be proposing the work to be funded by DC. Funding to the research institutions will be administered in individual projects according to individual project plans that are submitted in response to the open call for proposals that Jay described. I have only two slides left. And in terms of who owns intellectual property developed in the EBI, ownership follows a yours, mine, and ours model, essentially according to patent law in the U.S. Inventions can be controlled by DC personnel in their own space, rented space, will belong to DC. Inventions made solely by UCB personnel or the other at the academic institutions in their own space will belong to the academic institutions. And an invention made by one person from DC and one person from an academic institution will be jointly owned. And finally, in terms of licensing of EBI inventions to DC, when inventions arrive that are fully funded by DC, DC will have a time-limited first right to choose either a non-exclusive license on the one hand or an exclusive license. If DC chooses a non-exclusive license, they can have that non-exclusive license on a royalty-free basis, which means they don't have to pay running royalties on the actual product sold under the patent. But surely, if something is very important and is worth developing commercially that has a long R&D timeline, DC would choose the exclusive option, because it just would be something that they need to justify a huge investment in. And in that case, they could exercise that right and obtain an exclusive license, including under certain pre-negotiated terms for areas of technology where we can do market research on the appropriate financial terms. Am I over limit? Thank you.
Economics a little bit, and we're speaking with David Silverman, who's a professor in the Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics at the College of Natural Resources.
On the issue of agriculture, energy, and biofuel. The world is not waiting for us to produce this technology, as you can see. It's part of the natural evolution that is really happening in the world. If you look at the area of energy, is that energy consumption is increasing. It's increasing because of several reasons. Population growth, income growth. What is happening today is that in China, income has been growing by 10% a year over the last 15 years. And today they have six-lane highways, and soon there will be a lot of cars driving on these highways. So you see the statistic, 18 cars per 1,000 persons in China and 8,000 in the U.S. So if in China and India you start living even close to our standards, suddenly the demand for transportation will be immense. So, what is happening? Energy prices increase. This is an example of energy shock. So, energy prices are increasing, and when energy prices are increasing, it has various impact on the agricultural system. So already we have a significant impact on the agricultural system, but hopefully starting to grow and if we start adopting conservation technologies, there is much more interest in new products and new technologies that would save energy, and that really leads us to the issue of biofuel. Now, people look at a lot of alternatives to the energy situation. For example, conservation and efficiency. And we are lucky to have energy standards in California. As an economist, we for years spoke about taxation, and I believe energy taxes are great, but they are unpopular. All these countries continue. There are also movements to use to counter, but it's polluting and it's not very good to the environment. There are a lot of dreams like hydrogen fuel, electric, hybrid, there is a long way to go. And biofuel is something that is not easy, that is known and is available. In the 19th century, about 25% of the land was used for energy. Basically, states like Wyoming and Nebraska was gas station on the way west. So, to some extent, we are now at a century where we really live freely without using the land for using energy, and now we are coming back. So, the appeal for biofuel is a proven technology. We have a day, it can be adopted and adapted, it can address some of the climate change concerns, and it can also improve farm situation, because these farmers have to grow biofuel as wheat, the prices go up and they are richer, so it looks great. So if you look at all these graphs on the farm, they really show that there is a little bit of a boom. Altogether, we have about 33 million liters of ethanol, mostly in the US and Brazil, biodiesel grow in Europe, and biofuel starts having a role. Now, generally, the technology, though, is in infancy. The big thing is not to grow the biofuel, the big thing is to develop a processing facility, and almost all the incentives now are for a processing facility. Biofuel is not an agricultural problem as much as an industrial problem, because it changed the way that agriculture is done. But as I'll say later, the biofuel that we have now is not very efficient and it's quite problematic and it's a mixed blessing. So there are some benefits. You and all import a little bit reduction in climate change. In energy prices, it has a role, but there are a lot of problems. A lot of them going to energy crops, and there is less land for food and less land for the environment. There are pressure on water resources, there are higher wood prices. All of you heard about some of the problems that are occurring in Mexico. There is more vulnerability, there is less food stock, there are less inventories of grain. And these are the biofuels that we have. Now, the reality is that people in Brazil and the United States wouldn't wait to use the battery to do anything. They will develop biofuel. And this biofuel will take some land. And people in India already, it wasn't not a long time ago, think about growing wheat sorghum. And the reality is that the way things are, the middle class will drive in the car and the poor won't eat. So to some extent, when we look at the BP program and the future about, and we think about the future of biofuel, we really don't speak about something that is that, oh, we come with the idea and all the world will basically dance to our tune. We are in entering to an energy situation. Coal is not a biologist, but coal is a best choice for biofuel crop. That's the best we have in the U.S. Lubricant is a little bit better, but there are much, much better options, and this is the big challenge. And the challenge is to do it in a way that is sustainable, to harvest as much as you can, but still leave some residue so the environment will be sustained. So the basic challenge is how to mitigate the negative and social effects of biofuel and keep the planet. And the fourth thing that we have to take advantage of the tool of science, molecular and cell, and increase productivity not only of biofuel but also of agricultural crop. If we can double the productivity of corn with genetic modified crop, whatever, there will be more land for biofuel and more land for nature. If we basically be careful and if we will take some effort that are risk aware, to some extent, all the stuff and will enter. So to some extent, you can really with a system that increases productivity, reduce pressure on food prices, reduce pressure on land, reduce the use of input, and improve the net energy content. Now, obviously, I think that we have to study a lot. We don't know the answer, but to some extent, the trick is to develop a biofuel system that wouldn't be a burden, but rather would be an asset and increase our ability to perform. So what we really expect with biofuel is two things. On the one hand, gradual improvement in the Midwest of existing technologies. They are already twice as much efficient as they have been 10 years ago. On the other hand, breakthrough that will occur in depth in other universities will come with that will come with a new outcome. And the challenge are immense. How to produce fuel more efficiently, how to reduce the load on the land, how to reduce the load on the environment, and how to reduce the load of water. So to some extent, we will have a situation that agricultural policy will change. We will move from an agricultural policy to an energy and environmental policy. We will need the policies that will basically make sure that poor people are not hurt because we need fuel. We need to develop a system that will sustain the food processing industry. We need a system that will preserve land for biofuel, but still protect a lot of biodiversity and valuable species. And we need a defense system that energy will be as much a priority as any other area. And we spend billions of dollars on medicine. But if we continue with the situation that we have with energy, all our medicine research will help. So I think combining research with efficient policies, I think, is a big challenge. So we have an agenda of the social science research to understand the production economics of biofuel, to understand our energy and agricultural needs, to understand developing countries and what happened in development. I think this is a huge challenge because developing countries are now in a state of the energy demand, and what we do in biofuel and what we do in other alternative energy can affect climate change and the effects of developing countries. To understand the issue of biofuel and climate change, all the issues of R&D, this is a new experiment, and we have to follow it and to look at the social implication and how it works and how we can design IPR again. Biofuel will change the way that agriculture and the energy industry works. So an economy to understand industrial organization is very important. And all of this research has to be dynamic, it has to be empirical, it has to look at a lot of paradigm, it has to have an element of experience. But I really think that the basic point that we are dealing with is a new environmental paradigm. A climate change and energy scarcity basically have to look at, basically bring us to a situation where we have an environmental and humanitarian crisis. We really need a research that will be adapting and adopting, taking advantage of what we know and using the scarce resources reasonably. We really need to develop incentives and policies to adapt and conserve. We need to have emphasis on innovation and the new ways to adapt. We need an environmental entrepreneurship. And we need to take some sort of risk. We have to have risks that are reasonable, but we cannot avoid taking risks. And because if we take the small risk, we will avoid the big one. And I think that to some extent, the social science, if we can really look at the impact of the process, identify when it works well, and identify when it needs correction.
I just asked you
the supplement really is the right department head for the Building Technologies Department for the Environmental Energy Technologies Division of Mark Burke National Lab.
Thank you. Usually I'm the person standing between someone and lunch. Now I guess I'm standing between you and questions and answers. So I'll move quickly here. So we've been tackling this problem of impact of energy and climate change for 30 years. The focus started back in the 70s was a dollar focus and energy focus. We're shifting now to a carbon focus. But this biofuel world is interesting to me. I'm not really part of it, but I see some of the energy and excitement here that we saw in the 70s looking at the aftermath of the first energy shocks. And I think there's lots to be done here. I'm going to talk a little bit about what we've been doing and where we hope to head in the next 30 years here as well. The efficiency piece of this is, I would argue, the most important part. And Steve, I think, echoed that at the beginning. The analogy here with the leaky bucket, I think, is a good one. If you're trying to fill it, you want to plug the holes first. It's silly to keep pouring things in if you get all of it leaking out of the bottom. But the second point is that business as usual isn't going to get us there. So the normal mechanism of responding to these things aren't going to work fast enough and have enough. Aggressive efforts, R&D, breakthroughs are truly needed. And we've been working on this. We here as LBL and a lot of others in this area. For 30 years, I'm going to talk a little bit about what we've been doing, where we're going. And our division, which I think, at times I think of us maybe as the stealth division at the lab, in terms of working away at, we think, important things. We're quite well known in the energy efficiency world. You don't know how well known we are to all of you on campus. There are about 400 staff. Many of them include faculty and students on campus. We work all over the country and all over the world with others. And if you look at our funding level, 400 people, a little bit more or less over time, times 30 years, we've spent about $1 billion. Actually, we haven't spent, the government has spent, others have spent about $1 billion, and we're proud of some of the things we have to show for it. Let me start with a few background slides here, and I'm going to focus on the buildings part of this. And the first slide basically is saying why we're focusing on buildings. I've broken them up here by residential and commercial, but if you add these two, you get the total here. So you see that buildings have more energy impacts than any other sector of the economy. You can convert that to quads, that's what the energy guys in the buildings world are, quadrillion BTU. Dollars, it's a big number. It's one of those big numbers that Steve talked about before, the discretionary budget of the U.S., tons of carbon. Interesting number, the emissions from buildings are more than the entire country emissions of any country in the world except China. Where does it all come from? Where does it go? Well, here's a breakdown. We look for silver bullets. Well, we really need to look for silver buckshot because in the end, there's many, many different end uses. There's no one thing you can do in a building and solve a problem. There's not even five or six things you can do. We tend to tackle the areas that are largest, heating and cooling, lighting, for example, but you have to pay attention to all of these if you're going to make a difference out in the world there. And so this is sort of a framework for some of the things we do. Our work is scientific in nature, but we also look at the economic, the political aspects of this. You can't even find the right technical problem to solve if you don't understand the industry and the business. We focus on R&D, but we partner with others to move that R&D into the marketplace. If you don't work with the building industry, you simply don't find solutions and save energy. We don't make light bulbs. We don't make coatings on windows. We can invent them, we can develop them, but we have to convince others to make them. And then we close the loop by doing a lot of work in the field, measuring what's going on, and that feedback sort of sharpens the R&D in the future. Just to give you a flavor of some of the kinds of things we do, this one at the bottom here, we work on better lamps, controls, look at whole building standards. I'll give you some examples of a few of these as I go along. The next question is, you said, well, we spent $1 billion, have you done anything useful? Well, the National Academy looked at this 5 or 6 years ago. They did a study of the first, I think, 10 or 15 years of investments that DOE made, probably investments totaling $1 billion in all of the work that they did. And they found in the end that of hundreds of projects, only about 20 or 30 actually produced savings. But the savings they produced were huge, and four of them actually, part of the 10 or so was work done at Berkeley. There was work on tools. They had a hard time quantifying that, but they said it was big. The window coating work, the ballast work, between them, $23 billion of savings for investments, R&D investments in the order of tens of millions. And the biggest one by far was the work we did on standards, $48 billion in savings. This will actually end up being about 10% of all the use of your homes by the time 2025 rolls around. What does that look like in practical terms? Here's one example, bridges. If you look historically at what happened until 73, energy use went up, size went up. I think the size stopped going up because at some point you can't get them through the kitchen door. But energy use would have kept going up. But look what happened. It fell by a factor of two-thirds. And then the other thing people said was, okay, you made them more efficient, but you're going to make them so costly you can't afford to buy them. Well, look at what happened here. The price in constant dollars fell by more than a half. So the message is, if you're smart, if you tackle the right problem with the right approaches, you can save a lot of energy and you can do it cost effectively. Had we not, and we here isn't LBL or Berkeley, we as the country, had we not made all these changes, so here was the trend of 73, is actual energy use. If you project this trend upward, we would have been spending $1.7 trillion last year. Instead, we spent only $1 trillion on energy. So we saved $700 billion that was invested principally in education and other uses. Here are just some simple examples of technologies that have been developed at the lab. In each case, these were patented and licensed. They've had various rolled out in the real world. I'll comment that, since many of you, I think, probably researchers, the fume hoods in your lab, fume hoods use more energy than a house does, able to cut lighting use down here from halogen lamps to CFLs. I look up in the ceiling and I'm disturbed to see you've got 20-year-old technology in your own buildings, but maybe we can help you fix that. And in fact, if you apply that, this slide frankly isn't research. This is simply, if we simply put the best available lighting in every lamp and fixture in the country, we'd save the country an extra $10 billion a year quite cost effectively. And it's these kinds of things. There's all kinds of reasons why that doesn't happen. I won't get into that. We also produce information tools, not only for architects and engineers, but things for homeowners. In the end, each individual homeowner, each building owner has to take action. These are all on our website. And I should say here, we have everything we do is public, published. You can download all this if you either contact me at the end or Google on us. You can find all of this material. A couple of examples of websites. You put in your zip code, you can find out what the average use of the average energy use of homes in Berkeley is. You can plug in the details of your home and find out what you can do to make it better. We not only work close to home, but we work all over the world here. Three examples on the policy side. We help the government figure out what to buy and how to buy it. We help write reports like the IPCC report that's been referenced a few times, and we tend to obviously work on the efficiency parts of these reports. And in particular, we've done a lot of work in the developing world in the last 5 or 10 years. China is one. We've taken what we've learned about lighting, refrigerators, applying standards, and so on, and worked with Chinese colleagues to try and slow the growth over there. This is a huge issue. Several people have said, even if we do the right thing in the U.S., if we don't help our friends overseas, the planet is still going to have problems. There are lots of other things we do which are satisfying and important, but don't make the news often. We've helped develop cook stoves in Africa. We've developed water purification systems all over the world. We're developing, one of our folks is off to India to work on small LED lights to replace kerosene lamps that allow kids to read in the evenings in poor villages that aren't on the grid. So we do a lot of lower tech but critically important things all related to diesel energy. Let me talk for a few minutes here at the end about some of the projects that we're sort of moving towards these higher performing buildings with. We're looking at the integration of building systems. One of the problems in buildings, we have cooling problems and lighting problems. Well, we could black out the windows and solve a cooling problem, but then the lights would be on all the time. You have lots of glass, turn the lights off because it's the daylight, and the cooling won't be high. So what do you do? How do you balance this off? This is the subject of research projects that we do. Here's an example of applying research in the field. in this case, the New York Times, a well-known publisher to most of you, I hope, was building a 1.6 million square foot new office. This is an artist's view of it. They hired a European architect, they gave them a beautiful all glass building, and they came to us and said, wait a minute, we're going to have some problems, aren't we, with all this glass? And how do we solve this problem of shading and controlling the lighting system in a way that's affordable, reliable, and robust? That means simply they can operate it over time and it will work. They simply couldn't find these solutions in the marketplace. What we did was we convinced them to build a mock-up of, here's the floor of their building, to take the corner of the floor and build it as a full-size mock-up, almost a 5,000-square-foot mock-up. This cost them over $1 million, and we used public funding, actually the state funding at the time, to be inside of the mock-up. We installed a lot of equipment from different manufacturers. We tested it out. We helped them develop specs for this, and in the end helped them procure a system, a state-of-the-art system, the largest installation of automated motorized shades in the world and the largest installation of dimmable lighting in the world. The building is just about complete. This is a picture from a month or so ago. The lighting is installed in the first 10 floors. We'll go back and monitor this and see how it works. In the meantime, people doing the Freedom Tower and the World Trade Center buildings, 10 million square feet of new construction in New York, have come to us for help. Closer to home, if you take BART across the bay here and pop up in Powell Street or something like that, you'll see the new federal building. This is the only building of its size and scale where a large part of the office space has no cooling system in it. The way the building is cooled is it has automated windows that open in the evening. The cool San Francisco breeze flows across an open concrete ceiling. The ceiling cools down. In the morning, the windows close up, trapped with cool, if you will, and the building is designed to float through 3 days of the San Francisco heat wave. And this was done, obviously, with the architect came up with a clever idea. Eric is the engineering firm. GSA is the owner. GSA brought us in to add to the team doing CFP modeling, for example. They were going to build giant thermal chimneys on this building to make sure they had a good draft that would suck the air through the cross-section. We showed through modeling that they didn't need to do that, saving them $1.5 million. We're now in the building doing what's called occupancy evaluation, so GSA is paying us to go back in the building afterwards and make sure it all works. So these are exciting, cutting-edge things or projects that wouldn't have been done without this research component added to the puzzle. Closer to home, we've got what's called a LEED rating, and good environmental leading for rating on our newest lab building, and we hope to be engaged with the EDI building in the same way. We have test facilities up at Tommy Hill. I invite some of you to come up and take a look at it. This is the latest type of window coating. This is a type of coating that switches dynamically for small current through it, changes from clear to reflective inside you. We're helping the industry make better coatings, and we're helping architects and engineers understand how to use it. And my last three slides here pointing to the pathway to the future. The AIA, the architectural group in the U.S., has come up with a great vision, a challenge for 2030. By 2010, they want to make all buildings use half as much energy as they use today. And by 2030, go to what we call carbon neutral, which is drop the energy use by 80% or so and provide the remainder with on-site solar or some other source like that. If you could do that, you would bend that curve over to the 1990 levels and below, which is what we're trying to do. It's a great vision, it's the right vision, but they don't have a chance in hell of ever accomplishing it. There's simply no way you can change the building profession that much that fast again in a business-as-usual environment in 3 years or even 4 years. So what we've done here is mounted what we hope will be an activity that will exceed the size of your biosciences effort, a $200 million activity. This isn't for LBLUC, this is for the country, to tackle this problem to get to carbon neutral. It has a whole series of activities in it. This is not so much the research side. This is doing what we already know. This is replacing those lamps up there. This is the kind of New York Times GSA building innovation demonstration. And here's the laboratory breakthrough R&D to get to 80% savings. And in a former world, before last year, I would have said the likelihood of the government investing a lot of money is probably pretty small. But the world changed last November. And this week, we hope to sign a contract with the House of representatives to do a greening of the Capitol project, and their goal is to reduce the energy use of this complex of buildings to carbon neutral levels. So check with me in a year and we'll tell you how we're doing. Thank you.
Speakers to come up and sit on the attic, move the chairs into the middle. They're more comfortable that way. And please hand in questions to people who are in the aisle, and I will read out the questions and call the first one or two people to answer them. Which is a little bit short on microphone. Requirement of 5% of the Earth's land really less far-fetched than building X per day new nuclear plants to meet 100% of needs. So, Steve and Chris, I think.
The question was
5% of the Earth's land for it to be used as that less far-fetched than building a new nuclear power plant every 2 days, which is, I think, what Chris
said. I think there's going to be a lead time in both of these issues, and so one doesn't simply wave a wand and say there's a snap to something. I mean, this biofuels program takes a while to grow, and the nuclear program, if the world decides to reinvest in nuclear, which is not even clear, the United States is going to do this, quite frankly, in a big way. It will take a while. So it's one of those wait and see. It's very much like carbon sequestration. We're now sequestering test stations about a factor of a couple hundred times less than we need to make a 10% difference. And so just to scale up to that level and test it, is an issue. So in every inch of the way and every potential solution, there is not something we can say, slam dunk, this is ready to go, this 10%, another that other 10%. That's the best I can do.
Anybody else want to weigh in?
I just want to say, I think the Secretary's goal of 30% of transportation fuels by 2030 seems very manageable.
Alright, next question is on the organization of the EBI. Two pillars, one headed by UCB and the other by BP, reinforced by the IT regulation. But how will UCB and BP researchers cooperate? And in particular, how will research questions be decided on? That is, will UCB and BP researchers be working together under a common head of research? I think that's Chris or Jay.
I don't see, there's not really going to be a head of research, so as we envision it, as Jay said, we'll solicit proposals from the community, and those proposals will then be reviewed for scientific content and for focus on the general goals of the organization, which are quite broad. And then, in much the same way as a normal project grant, people will be funded to carry out those goals, and presumably, like all research grants and contracts, they'll be reviewed after some period to see whether progress is made or not. And so I think I envision it being very similar to the normal grant process. Perhaps the one thing that we hope will be different is that our goal in forming the EBI is to bring together a wide variety of expertise, all the way from social scientists, we have four laboratories envisioned in social sciences, to agricultural implement engineering, and the other is steam and chemical engineering and chemistry. So one thing we hope will be different is that the participants in the program will get broadly educated about all the components of the overall problem, and we might see broader approaches and collaborations between people across disciplines that have not been characteristic up to now.
I think one aspect of this is that the reason we have this call for proposals is that we want to go across campus and really get broadest ideas across campus. I mean, UC Berkeley, LBNL, Illinois. So we want these ideas to really bubble up from the researchers. And we anticipate through this proposal process that we'll come up with ideas that we never would have thought of in any other way. And I also should mention that, unlike maybe the federal proposal process, we anticipate this being shorter, quicker, easier.
Thanks, Jay. I think the next one is for Carol. Would you please elaborate on the pre-publication review process and how the IP terms deviate from standard policy for UCB with respect to jointly owned and UCB-owned IP rights? E.g., what constitutes a predefined option to obtain an exclusive license?
Okay, so there are three questions in there. The first one is, I mentioned that EP would have the right to review research from projects that it funds. And we call this a publication preview right. Because if we want to file a patent, we have to get the patent on file before either a written document is published or before a public presentation is made. We want to time the filing of the patent. However, we want to protect academic freedom, so we need to allow publication. So we allow a 30-day preview right of anything that we intend to patent to see if, for two reasons, there's anything in that publication that they might want to ask the university to file a patent on, and secondly, if the university may have inadvertently included some confidential information OPP. If that's the case, they would ask the author to redact that information, that they would have no other editorial rights over the entire content of that publication. I think the second question went to joint ownership. And indeed, it is different that if we have an invention made, a patent application with claims, a set of claims after that, where a given claim is invented by a party from DC and another claim is invented by a party from one of the research institutions, it will be jointly owned. And this is consistent with patent law, that by definition, a person who is inventor of the claim is an inventor on the patent. And since the inventor on the patent has an employment agreement with one of the research institutions, then that institution ends up with ownership of that patent by one of an invention made by one of their employees. The third one, I think, what was it?
What constitutes a predefined option to obtain an exclusive license?
So companies, when they sponsor research, know that we can only give them the first right to negotiate a license in the future when the intellectual property arises. We defer that negotiation and we defer the actual grant of that license until the IP exists, because we have to be able to see what the facts and circumstances regarding the IP are. For instance, if for some reason through the normal scientific process, a patent application is jointly owned by Stanford instead of being collaborated with a person from Stanford, then licenses would have to reflect that. Now, that shouldn't happen. If the lab studiously follows the plan and applies the funding for a project in a given way, all the resultant IP should be conveyable clean to DC without joint ownership or other contingencies. But if that were to happen, then at the time of licensing, the license would reflect the reality. So now, because companies going into a research project want to know what the sum total of the cost could be if any IP arises from the funding, they don't want it to be the sky's the limit. You know, come back in 10 years, we have a patent, and it's probably going to be millions and millions to license it. They want some certainty in order to take to their boards of directors that it's not going to be some astronomical number. So it is quite reasonable to pre-negotiate a particular range, either a license fee or a set range of royalty rates that the licensee will pay us if they commercialize a product under a patent right. And if they're pre-negotiated in the research agreement and IP arises using their funding, then we will follow those pre-negotiated ranges when we execute and perfect those licenses in the future.
Thanks, Tom. Slight change of topic here. Professor Somerville showed the current precipitation map of the USA and corresponding choice of favored biofuel crops in parts of the USA. How will climate change affect rainfall distribution and thus biofuel crop selection in parts of the USA? What areas of the world will become big biofuel producers after climate change effects?
The projections are that actually rainfall will decline in the continental United States and in Europe. So certainly that will affect Canada, actually, if it's more habitable, increased rainfall. Central America and parts of Africa also get very affected. In fact, I think I've heard the number that people will actually be in the hundreds of millions will be unable to grow enough food because of the projection is that by 2070, I think in certain parts of Central America and Africa, the annual rainfall will decline by about 40 centimeters a year, which is very substantial. So it will cause some change.
And that I just want to add that it doesn't mean food production will be used to Canada. It will increase, but Canada, as you may recall, is far north, and the sun hits Canada very blankly. So it means it's a bad situation for the world.
Okay.